Let's move on then to the lecture on teams. This is a lecture we had in Personnel Economics 1 in the winter semester, but since, you know, as I told you, some overlap is possible, here we are. Lecture on teams. Teams are very important. Most of the work today is done in teams, like it or not. And there are lots of reasons why teams are necessary, and lots of reasons why teams are actually the best way to organize production. But teams have one unfortunate problem, which is the problem of free riding, and there are several solutions to the problem of free riding in teams, some of which we will cover in this lecture. Now, here's a typical example of a situation where teams are, with all their disadvantages, such as free riding, where teams are the only technologically feasible way to organize production. This is a retail context, a typical retail shop like a bakery. I've done a lot of work with bakeries. You have a small shop with maybe 7 to 10 people employed on part-time basis doing different shifts at different points in time. So at any particular point in time, there will be, you know, between 1 and 3 people in a bakery. Now, the number of tasks that you have to do in a bakery, whoever worked in a small retail outlet such as a bakery or cafe or a convenience store, they can certify that the number of tasks is really huge. You know, there are hundreds of tasks. You need to keep the place clean. You need to make sure the assortment is on the counter. You need to make sure the customers are served. You need to make sure that the water in the back office isn't running. You need to make sure that the oven is on when it needs to be on and off when it needs to be off. And these tasks arrive stochastically, so there is a little bit of routine, but most of the time the tasks arrive and really randomly, and the work is centered around serving customers. So what it all means, lots of tasks arrive on a random basis. This essentially precludes specialization. Right, so you cannot really specialize in one particular task. You need to be a jack of all trades, and when several of the many tasks that you have to do arrive at the same time, you need to cooperate. No matter how much you hate your team members, no matter, you know, how much free riding there is in your team, you need to cooperate. You know, one needs to serve customers, other needs to clean up, a third needs to switch on the baking machine, etc. So the collective effort is essential in getting the place running. So now the such technological necessity of cooperation is a very powerful factor. Also, beyond the technological necessity of cooperation, there are significant effort complementarities. The term effort complementarities, what it means, it's another label for the weak link situation. When the output of the entire team is determined by the weakest, by the least productive worker in the team. This is a situation of effort complementarities. If one odd thing goes wrong, if one worker screws up in the task that this worker is doing at the moment, the entire team's output is going to be dramatically reduced, right? So what it means is that the effect on the team's output of a single worker is much more powerful than the share of this worker in the total team. If you have a team of, let's say, 10 people, then one worker screwing up may do much more damage than the 10% of the output that this team creates. So this is the weak link situation, and another more economics-y term for it is effort complementarities. So, and needless to say, with lots of tasks that team members have to handle, and only one task actually directly generating cash, which is selling things over the counter, you cannot very easily, well, you cannot at all, I would say, calculate the individual output of every individual employee, right? So, of course, one way to get around the existence of teams and the technological requirement of teamwork is to say, okay, let us somehow calculate individual outputs and reward people based on their individual outputs. Well, guess what? It's impossible. In most contexts, it's just impossible to do. Sometimes it's possible. In, for instance, high-end clothing shops where the business is not so brisk, where there aren't so many customers, in these shops, it's possible to record individual sales of sales personnel. You know, everybody has their own key, everybody has their own account, and you can see how many shoes or, you know, cars or whatever each salesperson has sold. And then, yes, it's a teamwork, but and there are still some complementarities, but they are weaker, and you can divide the total output by individual contributions, and you can reward these contributions. Now, but when you cannot divide the total output onto individual contributions, what you have is free riding. What you have is free riding, because if you get, you know, if you cannot attribute a certain parts of team output to the contributions of individual team members, you end up with a situation where a function of team's output is divided between team members in the form of a bonus or piece rate incentives. And mathematically, it means that the marginal product of your effort is the marginal output of the team divided by n, whereas the marginal cost of your effort is your own marginal cost of effort. And the presence of this 1 over n factor in the marginal benefit of your effort creates the free riding problem. The free riding problem being that the amount of effort that each individual team member invests in team production is below the optimally efficient level. What would be the optimal what would be the efficient level of effort? The efficient level of effort would be the effort which is determined by the marginal benefits equal marginal costs of effort. Okay. In the team, the optimal effort is determined by marginal costs of effort equals 1 over marginal benefits of effort. And of course, marginal benefits of effort decreasing with effort and marginal costs of effort increasing with effort, the factor of 1 over n makes the optimal effort well below the Pareto efficient. And a related problem, a related challenge in managing teams is how do you provide incentives? Should you make incentives individual or should you make incentives team-based? Right? So suppose for a moment that you can somehow divide individual incentives based on some individually observed performance measure. You can do that. In principle, you can find a performance measure, never mind it's useless in the team context, but you can find some performance measure which is attributable to individual and you can reward them. What are you going to have? You're not going to have free riding. So because if you reward based on individual performance measure, then there is no 1 over n, it's just 1. However, this performance measure may be useless because of the impossibility to divide, to attribute team's output to individual contributions. And even if it's somehow useful, even if it's somehow informative, if the informativeness principle of performance evaluation is there, is satisfied, what you're going to have is effectively no cooperation. So you're not going to have free riding, but you're not going to have cooperation, right? So you have your bakery, and you are at the moment doing the cleaning, and somebody is doing the sales, sales or operating the oven. You get a certain amount of money for cleaning. He gets a certain amount of money for sales. There is a customer coming in. And while this salesperson operates the oven, will you go and help and serve this customer? No, because you get money for your individual contribution, whereas the sales is, of course, a performance measure of the other guy. So there's a trade-off. On the one hand, team incentives is a recipe for free riding. On the other hand, individual incentives is a killer of cooperation. So to understand, to put some basic structure on the idea of free riding, consider the following simple model. It's not Bayesian statistics anymore. You have a very basic output function, and the cost of effort. The cost of effort is just quadratic function of effort. The total, the net utility of effort is determined by this expression, which is maximized at effort equal 1. So the optimal effort for an individual agent is equal to 1. Now, if you have n of these individual efforts who are brought together in a team, then the individual utility of every agent will be determined as 1 over n times the total of their efforts. This is the total output that they create, minus half of their individual costs of effort. And as you can see, as you may recall from 5 minutes ago, here is your 1 over n problem. When you maximize this expression with respect to each individual effort, you'll see that the optimal individual effort is just 1 over n, but we know that it has to be equal to 1 to maximize efficiency. So teams are, unless there are some mechanisms to ensure cooperation, and we will go through these mechanisms later on in the lecture, in the very basic case, teams are prone to free riding, and free riding is super welfare reducing. Now, it's a nice thought experiment to consider a more complicated situation in which there are synergies, in which teams, you know what synergies are, right? 2 + 2 = 5. The total outcome is greater than the simple sum of individual contributions. And teams' idea is to capture these synergies if they exist. So to model synergies, what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, well, unlike the individual output, which is just a linear function of effort, the team's output is a convex function of effort. It's a total effort raised to the power of alpha, where alpha is somewhere between 1 and 2. It has to be less than 2 for this optimization problem to have a closed solution, so that people wouldn't invest an infinite amount of effort, each of them. Now, redoing the same steps as before, you have the optimal individual effort, and this optimal individual effort can actually create an output which is larger than 1. It can, right? So, and if alpha is close to 2, if you have super high, synergies in the team production, then the total output is going to skyrocket. It's going to be really huge, right? So, despite free riding, teams' strong synergies between individual inputs actually, make teams a more productive solution than simply individual work. So it makes sense to create teams even in the presence of free riding. However, the efficiency losses from free riding are also exacerbated by the extent of synergies. So if you calculate, this is how much the team's output would have been if everybody cooperated, and this is how much the total cost of effort would have been if everybody cooperated. And you will very quickly find that the optimal individual effort is this, whereas that the optimal level of effort without free riding is larger than the optimal effort level of effort with free riding. This is the individual utility maximization level of effort with free riding, that is. This is the individual effort level that maximizes total utility, that is, without free riding. Okay, and it's much higher. And the difference between these two increases with alpha as well. So there are huge efficiency losses from free riding. Now, given that there are big efficiency losses from free riding, the world would have looked much more prosperous and much better if free riding could be eliminated or reduced to a minimum So what are the ways to avoid, to contain free riding? Right? There are many ways to avoid or contain free riding. So an obvious way is to reveal individual output and make incentives that would be contractable on individual efforts, right? But it's not always possible. Recall the first slide of the Teams lecture. The indivisibility of output into individual effort contributions makes this solution highly, highly unlikely to be practical. So you can employ peer pressure. There are performance norms which are revealed through various forms of feedback, including recognition. This was the topic of our last week's lecture. Or you can enforce these norms by peer pressure. This will be the topic of our next week's lecture. So there is some structure in this course. And peer pressure is actually quite effective way to fight free riding in teams. As we will learn, we will begin to learn today and we will continue to learn next week. Now, it may sound idealistic, it may sound too naive, but actually there is a case for relying on voluntary cooperations. The truth is, according to the research that we have so far, the truth is that most of us are actually not free riders somehow. So we are not all homo economicus, of course I am, but we're not all homo economicus, thankfully, right? And being a little bit irrational has its positive, has its as well as negative sides. Now, the positive side of being a little bit irrational is to be conditional cooperator. And what conditional cooperator means, we will study in a, we will see in a few slides from now, but basically conditional cooperators will to some extent cooperate. And punishment for failure to cooperate, which is related to peer pressure, but not is not exactly peer pressure, is a very effective instrument to ensure that people continue to cooperate. Now, the other two ways to get teams to cooperate are to have a boss who distributes team output between workers. We will see exactly how it works. It is a solution to the free riding problem, but it's not a stable solution to the free riding problem for the reasons that I will explain very carefully. Now, and finally, what you can also do is a small variation from the boss idea. You can actually have a leader who inspires with own example of being cooperator. Now, we will study this, the boss story today, and we will study the leader story. I think it will be one of the last lectures of this course, the lecture on leadership. And in particular, leading by example. Leadership is an effective way to ensure cooperation, but it can be unstable, as I will explain. So basically, there's no ideal way to ensure cooperation other than being nice and open and friendly and cooperative with people, which is, of course, tautological. Now, but there's a multitude of ways in which people think cooperation can be enforced. So let's start with voluntary cooperation. No particular reason why we should start with voluntary cooperation, but who cares? So voluntary cooperation, here is the story. It's a typical public goods model that I'm sure you've seen a lot of in the micro courses that you studied and public economics courses that you studied. So think about an investment scheme which pays beta times n return on investment, right? So if a team of size n pulls together different resources, then the total output that this team will create is going to be beta times the sum of the individual contributions. Now, everybody has a budget of z. This is how much money you have, and you can choose between contributing to this public good and keeping the money in your pocket. Now, the more you contribute to the public good, the larger this thing is, the less money you have in your pocket, right? So here's a trade-off. And the question is, how much would you contribute to public good given this payoff function? And the answer is very easy. As long as beta is less than one. Obviously, if beta is more than one, then it's super productive. But as long as beta is less than one, the profit maximizing solution will be individual effort equals zero. So everybody would contribute zero into public good and will keep all their endowments intact. Why? Well, just take a derivative of this function with respect to individual effort level. You will have minus one here and beta here. As long as beta is less than minus one, you have a corner solution, and therefore the individual effort levels will be the minimum possible, which is zero. Now, but maybe it's okay. Maybe you know, this funny investment scheme is not so good. After all, you know, maybe you're really better off keeping your money in your pocket rather than investing it. Well, not really. It can actually be productive. As long as beta is larger than 1 over n, the total benefit from this investment scheme is larger than the total cost from this investment scheme. What is the total benefit here? The total benefit is going to be, well, if beta is larger than 1 over n, the total benefit is going to be larger than the sum of individual contributions. Whereas the total cost is going to be just the sum of individual contributions. The total of this will be larger than the total of this as long as beta is larger than 1 over n. So the efficiency maximization would dictate that everybody spends all their money on investing in the public good. And when everybody does so, the benefits will be so huge that they will more than justify the costs. Here is a little numerical example. You have n equal 4. Everybody has a budget of 10 euros, and the return parameter is 0.5. Is it larger than 1 over n? Yes, it is, because it's larger than 0.25. Is it less than 1? Yes, it is. So what will be the contribution that will maximize the total utility? The contribution that will maximize the total utility is to contribute everything to this public good. How much will they actually invest in the public good? Zero. It's a very well-known problem that everybody likes to talk about public good. Everybody likes to say, oh, how nice it is when streets are clean, how nice it is when there is plenty of street lights, how fantastic it is when we have forests and playgrounds and what have you. But when it comes to, you know, actually contributing to the creation of these facilities, people find all sorts of reasons not to. That's why taxation exists, by the way, one of the reasons why taxation exists, right? The state recognizes that public goods are more beneficial than the costs of creating them, and they impose the necessary contribution that everybody has to make to the public good of running the country by charging income tax. As one, I don't remember who, some great person said, taxes is the price that we pay for civilization. Yeah, think about it. So it's a deep idea, developing which, of course, is outside of this course. Now, contrary to the prediction of this simple public good theoretical model, people cooperate. If you actually play this public goods game, if you take people in the lab and say, okay, you've got 10 euros, there are four of you, and beta is half, how much would you contribute? What you will observe is not everybody will contribute zero. Of course, there will be economic students who will contribute zero, but not everybody will contribute zero. So the average contribution level is above zero. And that means that people do cooperate. But this cooperation is not universal, and this cooperation is below the efficient level. So here are some basic facts about cooperation observed in many, many hundreds of lab experiments, that some of which were actually run here in Konstanz by Urs Fischbacher and associates. There is cooperation, but cooperation is low, below the optimum, and it really runs out when the public goods game is approaching its end. If you separate people into partners and strangers in some sense, you know, say, okay, the partners are those who wear blue t-shirts and the strangers are those who don't wear a blue t-shirt, then partners will contribute more than strangers. But even among the partners, at some point, people will start contributing because they will realize that the game is approaching the end. A very powerful stylized fact is that when you have a possibility to punish, cooperation shoots up, so punishment is good. You should have prisons, even in the ideal open and free society. And people actually choose deliberately to apply punishment, even though it's totally unproductive, right? It's not, it's hugely unproductive. It's costing a lot of money to keep people locked up. It's very unproductive to hire lots of people who will give parking fines to inappropriately parked cars, actually, right? People do that because they want to, the authorities do that because they want to try and ensure everybody cooperates, everybody is behaving, everybody shows good citizenship. Now, here's a picture that shows that cooperation reduces, even for partners. Nothing spectacular here, nothing very, you know, puzzling here. What is more interesting, I would argue, is the notion of conditional cooperation, which I advertised already. So what is a conditional cooperation? Conditional cooperation is a behavior where people cooperate provided everyone else does. So here's a quote from Milton Friedman that I think communicates this idea very clearly, right? I am going to like you if you like me, right? I'm going to be nice to you if you're going to be nice to me. If I see you contribute to the public good, then I will contribute to the public good. But if I see you not contributing to the public good, I will not contribute to the public good. I am the same person, my preferences are fundamentally stable, but in different environments, I may behave very differently when it comes to contribution to public good. This is a notion of conditional cooperation. Now, here is a very influential paper, by Urs Fischbacher and Simon Gechter. Ran a lab experiment. It was a game that they played in the lab, a public goods game, and in each of these rounds they ask people how much would you contribute to the public good. Now, you can calculate the average contributions. This is pretty much what we have seen before, something like this. The average contribution is not zero and it declines with time. Fine. Right, they went a step further. These authors went a step further. They actually said, let us look at individual patterns in contribution to the public goods and try to classify these patterns into patterns that would be consistent with a certain type of cooperation. So this is this is an intellectual exercise which first identifies a pattern of contribution to the public goods, which is characteristic of no cooperation, total altruism, strategic contribution, conditional cooperation, and the pattern that doesn't really make any systematic sense. And they would classify every individual, every of the hundreds of individuals that were present in their lab into one of the four groups: conditional cooperators, free riders, triangle cooperators, and others. And they would then calculate the shares of people whose contribution to public good fits a particular pattern. So who are the free riders? Free riders are very easy to classify. Who are the free riders? They are the people who will always contribute zero. They will always behave in a narrow economic, homo economicus way, by always maximizing their individual utility. They are not conditional cooperators, they are free riders. So whoever always contributes zero is classified as a free rider, and look here, there are 23% of free riders. A big share, non-negligible share, right? So, but most of us are actually conditional cooperators. How do you classify conditional cooperators? Well, conditional cooperators will contribute the more, the larger is the contribution of the others. So to measure the propensity for conditional cooperation, they had questionnaires, they had incentivized questionnaires, where they asked, if Bob contributed €2 to the public goods project, how much would you contribute? And people would say, oh, I would contribute 1.5, or I would contribute 2. Okay, then you're a conditional cooperator. If Bob contributes 2, if Bob contributes 4 to the public goods project, how much would you contribute? Oh, then I would contribute maybe 3 or 4. So if people do that, then they are conditional cooperators. If people keep saying I will contribute 0 no matter what Bob contributes, then they are, of course, free riders. Okay, and the share of people who report that they would contribute the more others contribute, they are conditional cooperators, and their share in the sample is 55%. So, and together with free riders, conditional cooperators make up for more than 3/4 of the population, right? So we live in a world which is full of free riders, no doubt about it. But the majority, the weak majority of the population of the world are actually conditional cooperators. People are not that bad, as bad as economic theory predicts them to be. Now, there are other groups of people behaving with different degrees of strangeness. Here are the triangle contributors, not very interesting for our lecture, but these people like to think of themselves as super strategic. So they try to mimic conditional cooperators when contributions are low, but when contributions are high, they reduce their own contributions dramatically. So what's the story? They want to be strategic. They want to send the signal, as long as sending the signal is not too expensive. They want to send a signal, look, I'm conditional cooperator, cooperate with me. But when you're so naive as to really, you know, invest a lot of money into the joint project with triangular contributors, to consider your money gone because they will withdraw their contribution. Yeah, so these type of people, 12%, and others, I don't know, all sorts of people who contribute to the public good a non-zero amount no matter what, and they are not conditional cooperators. So there's plenty of conditional cooperation, which gives justification, one of the justifications why teams exist, and hope that the power of teams to create synergies in production may be harnessed by strengthening the appeal to conditional cooperation, and if necessary, reinforcing this appeal with punishment. Hence the next slide. So far, what we've seen is people contributing out of their own will. They are rewarded based on the contribution of themselves and the contributions of others. But if they withdraw contribution, they are not punished. Here is Ernst Fehr and Simon Gechter, who thought about the idea. Okay, what if we punish? What if we give people the possibility to punish the people who have not contributed to the public goods, right? So, and they played a slightly more complicated game. So here's the public goods game, standard, and then they revealed the actual contributions of people to their teammates, and they said, "Look, Bob has contributed 0. You have the possibility to punish Bob by pressing this button, and if you press this button, Bob will lose €2 from his budget. Pressing this button is going to cost you 50 cents. Do you do this or do you not do this?" Some people, you know, the homo economicus would say, of course I'm not going to do this. I mean, I don't care about Bob. Of course Bob is not a cooperator, but I'm a free rider as well, so I'll keep my money to myself and I will not indulge in the totally unproductive activity of punishing free riders, because you know this other guy is going to lose lots of money, but you don't care, you are going to lose money, And that's why you wouldn't want to do this if you were a sort of homo economicus, basic economics organism, rather than, you know, the slightly boundedly rational conditional cooperator. Now, look here. These are the periods of the public goods game. So initially they played the public goods game without punishment possibility, and we see the usual picture. The usual picture being that there is a little bit of cooperation going on, but it goes down. And then they, you know, on the in their Z3 screens, they saw a notice saying, guys, now you can punish the free riders. And here are the contributions of your teammates. And the levels of cooperation in the presence of punishment has increased dramatically for both partners as well as strangers. So punishment is costly. This is one uncomfortable fact about it. It's expensive to run prisons. So a couple of questions. Is punishment effective? So far here we looked at the benefits from punishment. Cooperation goes up. But we haven't incorporated the costs of punishment. This is just contributions to the public goods game. These are not net benefits of public goods. Net benefits being, of course, the output that these contributions create minus the costs of contribution minus the costs of punishment. And so question number one, is punishment efficient? And question number two, related to number one, is if punishment is efficient, would people choose punishment? In Fair and Gechter experiment, there was no option. There was either punishment by default, and all you could do is, you know, decide how much you want to punish. You could choose zero, but the punishment option was always there. Or there was no punishment option at all. But here is a research team of Professor Gürerk. I don't know her first name. Bernd Erlenbusch and Professor Rockenbach. I forgot her first name. We have met. So they published in the best scientific journal of the world. This is the best journal you can publish. And the idea they had was truly, truly great. The idea was, let's play public goods game. Nothing very exciting about it. Hundreds of papers playing public goods game. The twist they introduced to the literature is, let us give subjects the choice of having a punishment or not having a punishment. So here's the period of public goods game, and they had several conditions, right? They had several conditions in their experiment. They had a condition in which you can choose the sanctioned institution. This is the SI treatment. So some people would be assigned into this treatment randomly. And the second condition that they had was sanction-free institutions. So this was a treatment in which participants randomly selected into it could just play the public goods game, but they wouldn't have this. But they wouldn't have this possibility. Now, those who choose to be in the sanction-free institution soon discovered that that hardly anyone was contributing to the public goods game. Those who chose the sanction institution soon discovered that the presence of the sanction really increased, not only keeps cooperation at a higher level than without a sanction, but actually also increases over time as people learn that there are consequences for their action. And the third result, which is my favorite, is that, well, if you look at the percentage of people who choose to be in the sanction-free institution versus the sanction institution, you can press a button and you can choose to be without punishment or choose to be with punishment. Initially, the majority of people didn't like the idea of punishment. Punishment is unproductive. Punishment doesn't sound nice. So the majority of people, 65% initially, chose to be in the sanction-free institution. But as the game progressed, they got fed up. They got fed up. You know, they were contributing. They were trying to be good citizens, and they saw lots of free riders, and they said, enough. I'm gonna choose at a personal cost to myself, I'm going to choose to have an institution, to choose to have this button that allows me to punish the free riders if I choose to do so. And as you can see, the share of people who chose sanction-free institution is going down with time. And the share of people who choose the sanctions institution is going up with time. So, three findings, two of them are not very interesting. The first two findings are that the contributions are higher and in the punishment condition than in the no punishment condition. And the second finding is that the contributions in the punishment condition increase, whereas the contributions in the no punishment conditions decrease. This is what we've seen. The really revolutionary finding here, really great finding, is that there's more and more people choose to actually have punishment. Well, so punishment works. Punishment works, and that's why you have all these disciplinary procedures and formal and informal actions. You can have a voting into team. You can have a voting out of team. There are potentially, you know, there are sometimes quite heated discussions about individual contributions of people. Think about, you know, Wohngemeinschaft or you know, some groups of people who have some public good mechanism to ride, to run, they have or very often recourse to punishment, verbal or material. But this is not the only way to ensure cooperation. The next item on our agenda is how about trying to have a boss? So far we looked at the so-called self-organized teams, the teams that had no hierarchy, just everybody is equal. Sort of commune of people. How about the boss? You know, a lot of teams actually have the boss. And the next few slides are going to show that having a boss, it actually makes a lot of sense. Suppose there's a boss, and the boss is totally unproductive in the sense that the boss doesn't really add anything to team's output. The only role that boss has to play is to oversee the contributions of team members and award, give different amounts of reward, give different shares of output to team members. So there's nothing that prevents the boss from act opportunistically, and then it's back to free riding. But a reasonable boss will not act opportunistically. A reasonable boss would do two things. First, he or she will introduce a performance target, which is equal to, guess what, the efficient level of output. And they will say, the boss will say, if you, the team, do not reach the efficient level of output, you will get a bonus of 0. But if you do reach the efficient target, then the output that you produce is going to be given to you. So that's one reasonable thing that a reasonable boss could do. The other reasonable thing is to award individual team members in proportion to their individual contribution to the team. This is an immensely reasonable thing to do. The only problem is that whether the boss is able to do this depends on the ability of the boss to observe individual contributions, which, as we know, may be limited or non-existent at all. So here's an old paper by our good friend Bengt Holmström, Career Concerns, Lecture 5, remember? So Holmström has written a lot of papers, and this is one of them, where he discusses the role of boss in teams. So it's a fundamental paper. Of course, it's not only about the role of boss in teams, but we will take parts of this paper which is related to the boss. So this is the story with the public goods game in Holmström's notations. Here is the output. Now, this output is shared between the members of a team, and the total amount of output is X, and each member of a team receives, member I of a team receives the share SI of X, so that the sum of the shares is equal to X. The total, the output is fully distributed. Notice that it's not necessarily equal division. It could be unequal division. So some people could get more, other people could get less. As long as the output is totally divided, we are in Holmstrom's model. Now, what is the individual utility? The individual utility is the difference between the share that you will get minus the costs of your contribution towards the output produced by the team. Now, what is your Pareto efficient in the presence of cooperation? What is the level of effort A that is efficient? The level of effort A that is efficient, the first best level of effort A, as you all know from the efficiency story, is the effort that maximizes the total welfare, which is the difference between the output, which is a function of effort, and the total costs of effort, which is the function of individual costs of effort. Now, if you take this, if you maximize this expression with respect to A, then you will have that the Pareto optimality implies that the marginal benefit of effort, which is X prime, has to be equal to the marginal costs of effort, which is V prime. V is a cost of effort function. But if you do the Nash equilibrium, if you maximize this function rather than this function, what you're going to have is you're going to have S prime times X prime minus V prime. So see the difference? Here is just X prime minus V prime. And here is S prime times X prime of effort minus V prime. Now notice that these two first order conditions are inconsistent, right? It's inconsistent with the requirement that the sum of these S primes is equal to 1, which comes from equation, which comes from this equation. So if you take the derivative of the, if you take the sum of S primes, take the derivative, sum of S prime has to be equal to 1. But it means that the individual SIs, SI primes, are less than 1, less than or equal to 1. So the optimal effort level that everybody individually determines is less than the effort level that is required to maximize efficiency. We have seen this. This is not something that we would say wow. Now, what we would say wow is an ingenious solution that Holmstrom thought through his maths to this free rider problem. He said, well, what shall we do? What can we do to make sure that everybody in the team, without monitoring, without cooperation, without punishment, remember it was early 80s, these ideas of cooperation and punishment appeared 20 years after. Back then people didn't think about these things. Without cooperation, how can you ensure that everybody voluntarily provides the first best level of effort? And Holmstrom's idea is this. Let us relax the requirement that the sum of shares of individuals in the total output is strictly equal to 1. So let us relax this requirement. Let us allow it to be less than 1 in some cases. So we move. It's very important to understand. We move from the situation in which whatever output team creates is distributed in some proportion between people to a situation in which not all the output that teams produce is distributed between its members. Right? So, and if that's not the case, if the sum of the shares of individual workers, of individual team members in the total output is less than 1, then you can think of the sharing scheme. There are potentially more than one of such sharing schemes, and thinking about categorizing all of them, I think, is mathematically challenging. But one very simple scheme says you will get a share equal to B if the total output of the team is at least as high as the efficient level. If the total output of the team is less, this is a typo, it has to be less. If the total output of the team is less than the efficient level of output, then everybody is getting zero. Now, given this distribution rule, do you see how this restriction is relaxed? This restriction is relaxed because if the team's output is less than its efficient level, everybody is getting zero, the sum will be zero, which is less than one. So if you allow this to happen, and if you set the bonus be such that the sum of individual bonuses is equal to the output the team produces, then the Nash equilibrium effort level under this scheme will be equal to the first best, the efficient level of effort. Try it at home as a practice question to prove this Nash equilibrium result. But it is the case. So if you move from the restriction that all output will always have to be shared, if you relax this restriction and allow some of the output, or in this case all output, to go somewhere else, then you can arrive at the first best solution, even when there's no cooperation. Yes. Now, why do we need the boss? The boss is totally useless. The boss is not himself or herself producing any output whatsoever. Why do we need the boss? We need the boss because in the absence of the boss, the efficient Nash equilibrium is not attainable. You're not going to have it. Why aren't you going to have it? Because people will... If you don't have the boss, there will be no one to grab your output and leave you with zero. So whatever output you will produce will by default be distributed between yourselves. And if that's the case, then we're back to the free riding equilibrium in which no one works at all. You understand? So only if the boss is there can people achieve the optimal effort level. If the boss is not there, no one can take their output from them, and then they can, you know, we're back to the situation of free riding when everybody is producing zero. So now you could ask a legitimate question, but what about the boss basically reneging on this rule, and even if people contribute the efficient amount of effort, why don't the boss just take the output and walk away? There is experimental evidence, which we may or may not have time for during this lecture, that shows that sometimes it does happen. But this is not an equilibrium phenomenon, because in equilibrium it's not in the boss's best interest. Why not? Because if boss does so, people will put in zero effort and everybody will be left with zero. So you can have an equilibrium. You can have it as an equilibrium where everybody does zero and both get zero. But an equilibrium in which people contribute the first best and both still get zero is also an equilibrium. Now, the multiplicity of equilibria in this game makes the solution of having a boss in the team to ensure everybody puts in first best unstable. Why is it unstable? Well, first of all, as we have just found out, there is a second Nash equilibrium where everybody is putting zero effort and boss gets zero because there's nothing to share. It's very easy to show, right? Looks like a simple 2-point question on the exam to show that a contribution of above zero but below the efficient level is never going to be in equilibrium. So we're talking about two equilibrium. Now, another explanation, more interesting than the multiplicity of equilibria, is a very clever idea that soon these guys published. They said that bosses may behave opportunistically and not in the primitive sense of just grabbing everybody's output and walking away. They can behave more opportunistically than this, more cleverly than this. They can actually cooperate. They can collude with one particular team member. You know, they can say, okay, if so, everybody knows that if they produce below the optimal level, then they will get zero. And therefore, in the Nash equilibrium, everybody will work hard and produce the optimal level. But the boss takes one particular team member and says, don't work too hard, relax, don't work too hard. If everybody is putting in the first best level and you don't work too hard, then the total output will be below the first best level. I will grab this output. People will be left with nothing, but for your cooperation, I'll give you a cookie. That's also an equilibrium, which we should not ignore. The possibility of the boss colluding with team members to rob the hardworking but naive members of the rest of the team. So it's tricky, having a boss does help. It is one of the solutions to prevent free riding in teams. Many teams have boss and have bosses, but it doesn't always work for the reasons that we have just discussed. Now, next one. Cooperation may emerge as a result of repeated interaction. And this is one of the easiest ideas of today's lecture, because you all remember the basic Unternehmensorganisation course, where repeated interaction and collusion was taught to you. Remember collusion? Repeated interaction? Yeah? So you have no clear end to the game. There is a probability that it will occur. There are, let's say, two people playing public goods game, and if we are talking about, say, what's known as the grim trigger strategy, when people will withdraw cooperation forever when they see their partner not cooperating once, then the people would have a choice between whether to continue to cooperate and always get a larger share of the public good, because it's now more public good, a larger amount of public good, and not cooperating by, free riding in one of the rounds of the game and then sacrificing the benefits from cooperation forever. So in case they cooperate, so you can either cooperate or you cannot cooperate, there is a payoff associated with cooperation and there is a payoff associated with shirking. What is the payoff from cooperation? The payoff from cooperation is your share in the public good created is the share in the public good created when everybody cooperates times the discount factor. And the discount factor is just the probability that the game occurs divided by the 1 plus R, where R is the discount interest rate. So this is your present value of cooperation. This is your present value of shirking. Now, you can deviate from cooperation in one round. And if you deviate from cooperation in one round, you're going to earn a lot of money because everybody cooperates and you get still a large amount of the slightly lower public good because you didn't cooperate. But then everybody will shirk forever. And so your profit forever will be the lower profit from shirking. Now, if you solve this inequality, to answer the question, will people cooperate or not, means to solve to answer a question: under what circumstances will the discounted profit from cooperation be larger than the discounted profit from no cooperation? And so solving this inequality with respect to the discount factor, we get this result. The discount factor has to be large enough. Sorry, is it the discount factor? No, it's not the discount factor. It's this delta thing. Delta thing has to be large enough to maintain cooperation. Now, what is delta? Delta is P divided by 1 plus R. Delta has to be large enough. What it means? It means that the probability of the game occurring has to be large enough to sustain cooperation. And the discount rate R has to be small enough, right? So if delta is large enough, is larger than the ratio between the differences in profits from deviation and cooperation here and the profit from deviation and shirking here, then people will voluntarily choose to cooperate. Now notice that this is not a story of conditional cooperation. This is not the story of the boss because there's no boss, or at least not yet, right? This is a story about people choosing to cooperate because they anticipate that the game will repeat itself potentially infinite number of times, and they had better cooperate to ensure everybody cooperates rather than shirk one time, get more money in this particular period, but then everybody will start shirking and their payoff will dramatically decline. So you can have, by the same logic as you have collusion between firms in oligopolistic market, you will have cooperation between individuals in the public goods game if this game is infinitely repeated. Okay, so let us bring the boss from the cold. Let us put together the public goods game, which is repeated. I'm not saying infinitely, just repeated. And the boss. If you add the boss to the public goods game, what's going to happen? Very interesting story here. And what's so interesting about this story? If you have a team of people who simultaneously decide whether to cooperate or not, cooperation will only be sustained if everybody's delta is larger than this. If you have a team, you have people who have a larger discount rate R, and for them, delta is going to be low, right? So if you have large and heterogeneous teams of people, it's possible that there will be one bad apple in the team for whom this condition for cooperation just doesn't satisfy. And this team member will not cooperate, he will free ride, and it takes just one free rider in the team for the entire team to start free riding, right? So it is mathematically true that cooperation will flourish if people are patient enough, but what is equally mathematically true is that the cooperation in teams can be very delicate because it depends, it requires that everybody in the team should have high enough delta. And if that's not the case, then cooperation quickly unravels and becomes free riding instead. So let's add the boss. What is the boss doing? The boss, it's related to Holmstrom, but not exactly. In Holmstrom, the boss just calculates the total output of the team. If it's above the efficient level, it pays the bonus to the team. If it's below the efficient level, he gets the money and puts it in his pocket. That's the only thing that boss does. The boss does in Holmstrom. In here, in this story, the boss actually has access to information about individual contributions of team members to the total public goods, and the boss can reward team members knowing how much they have contributed. Now, needless to say, the boss can also deviate from cooperation. The boss's deviation from cooperation would mean failure to reward people and instead appropriating the team's output entirely to themselves. So the same consideration applies to the boss. If the boss's delta is high enough, there will be cooperation and the boss will reward people for their contributions. If the boss's delta is not high enough, then there will be free riding because once the boss appropriates the entire output, everybody will understand that it's no point contributing to the team anymore and start free riding. The difference between the situations with and without the boss is that unlike in the situation without the boss, where everybody's delta matters, in a situation with the boss, it's only the boss's delta that matters, right? If there is a boss, it doesn't matter what your time preferences are, because you have incentives from the boss to receive the more output, the more money, the higher your contribution is. One theoretical hypothesis is to say, well, in teams with the boss, as compared to teams that are self-organized, Cooperation is more sustainable because it depends on the preferences of just one person, namely the boss, rather than every team member to the same extent. Now, to test this story, here's an old paper by three famous Dutch economists. They played public goods game, nothing special here. The twist that they introduced to the literature was to have treatments in which there was a boss and treatments in which there was no boss. Now, we know that if you have repeated game, cooperation may emerge as an equilibrium phenomenon, at least temporarily, right? But we also have a reason to believe that when you do have boss, when you do have the boss, this cooperation will be more sustainable. In other words, you will see more cooperation in teams with the boss than in teams without the boss. And that is indeed the case. You do have higher levels of cooperation in teams which have the boss, or what they call the leader, than in teams that don't have the boss and share the output that they produce in equal parts between themselves. So the boss is a sensible idea, even though sometimes the boss behaves opportunistically. But when the boss behaves opportunistically, hardly anyone puts in any effort. So it's sort of self-enforced mechanism that checks on the boss's propensity to behave opportunistically. It's very hard for bosses to be opportunistic in effective teams. Now, let's wrap up what we have learned today. Is, well, the boss makes sense. Teams is not an ideal economic mechanism because of the free riding problem. There is cooperation, mostly conditional cooperation. Most of us are conditional cooperators. Cooperation can go up when you introduce punishment, and cooperation does go up when you have the boss. So, the effectiveness of having a boss in the team depends on some at least weak fairness considerations. So when the boss behaves opportunistically, then there is no output to divide. You know, the teams become dysfunctional. It's only when the boss does an honest job in distributing the team's output in fair proportion to the individual contributions of team members, only then do teams work effectively. If the boss acts purely in their own interest, there is no positive effect on team outcome. There are a couple of limitations which are self-explanatory. The last thing... Okay, let me see what the last thing I have to say. Yeah, basically that's just a summary. So what you have is you have cooperation. You have cooperation that works better with the punishment. And bosses is one popular mechanism to ensure cooperation with or without the punishment. That's not the whole story of teams, by the way. As I said in the beginning of the lecture, there will be a lecture on peer effects. Peers and norm enforcement are another mechanism to ensure functional teams. We will also have a lecture where we look at leaderships and look at the difference between the leader and the boss, which difference is actually quite substantial and interesting. So, thanks for your attention. See you next week.